Hi, I'm Katrina Daniel, and welcome to Primetime Crime, a podcast for people who want to know what goes on behind the scenes of the most notorious trending crime stories and what's going on in the minds of those involved in those stories. What are the detectives, the judges, the defense attorneys, and the prosecutors thinking? You'll hear it all on Primetime Crime, the podcast. Hey, this is Primetime Crime. I'm Katrina Daniel, and the most watched trial this week and for the next several weeks, as long as it takes, is the sex trafficking trial of former British socialite Ghislaine Maxwell. You know, Jeffrey Epstein's madam, girlfriend, best friend, facilitator, whatever title you want to give her. Usually it's disgraced socialite. Maxwell has tried to get out of prison four times, offering to renounce her British and French citizenship, promising not to flee the country, offering the government millions of dollars to let her out on bond. But nope, wasn't happening. Judge Alison Nathan has shot her down every time, so Maxwell is now in the first week of her trial. McClatchy News Service reporter Ben Weeder is covering this trial, and he has some great insights to share. Ben, thanks so much for joining us again. This has obviously been, close to your heart. If not your heart, then at least your mind. Let's talk about the Ghislaine Maxwell trial. Tell me, as a reporter and as the partner reporter for Julie Brown, how does this work out logistically?
Yeah, so it's interesting. Julie's in New York at the case, and Julie has not been shy, I think, in talking about some of the logistical issues with the case. So we got thrown a little bit of a curveball as reporters because About a month or two ago, when we had checked with the court, at that point, they were still planning to offer phone access. So our original plan was, Julie's in New York, I'm listening on the phone in DC, and, you know, we're sort of filling in the blanks. If she misses something, I can fill in, whatever. They decided a few weeks ago that they were changing the policies in the court, and they weren't going to allow telephone access anymore. And further, because of COVID, they're limiting how many people can actually be in the courtroom itself. And so the vast majority of reporters and the vast majority of anyone who's interested in seeing the case, who's not a family member, a victim, is not in the courtroom. So they're relying on the video feed, which I think has mostly been okay, although there were technical difficulties on the first day of the trial that delayed the beginning of the trial as they were trying to work out the details of the video feed. And from what I've heard from Julie, every day, just the security checks and the COVID checks that they're doing when people go in, it just makes for a very long, difficult process to get access. And so it's presented some challenges from a reporting perspective. And I think it's helpful that the way we have it set up, by virtue of the fact that I'm in DC, I'm able to kind of, you know, she can quickly call me in the 10 minutes she has a break where she can have access to her phone and give me a feed on what's happening. And I can get it into a story because, you know, the way the courts work, the federal courts work, is you go in and you don't have your phone, you don't have access to anything if you're not a regular reporter who only covers the courts. And so it does make it very difficult from the perspective of trying to make sure you're accurate. We have been getting transcripts. We're part of a consortium of media organizations that are sharing transcripts of the proceedings every day, which is very helpful. Brilliant. So I'm reading the transcripts, she's reading the transcripts, and it's a way to make sure that we're being as accurate as possible because, you know, the language matters in this trial as in any trial. And, you know, you want to be as accurate as possible. And when you don't have your phone and you're not able to record things, it is challenging to make sure that, you know, you're getting every quote down right and everything like that. And then you're not missing something.
It really is not helpful to us as journalists to not have a camera in federal court. Yes. When I was covering state courts in Miami-Dade court, you know, there would be one camera in the courtroom and it would feed into a room adjacent where there were 15, 20 reporters and everybody could sit and take notes on everything that went on. And it's a real shame that they don't allow that in federal court. That would be so much easier.
Yeah, no, I think they have a video recording that shows up in the overflow room, but no one else can see it outside. And they can't use electronic devices. So for example, if you wanted to be typing notes, you can't do that.
You can't, in other words, you as a reporter can't get your iPad into the courtroom?
Nope.
Does that vary from judge to judge?
It's a good question. I wouldn't know the answer to that. I mean, I know when I've covered Supreme Court proceedings, and I think I had to surrender I think if I recall correctly, I had to surrender my phone. I don't think I could bring electronics into the Supreme Court.
Yeah, no, I've not been able to bring, but my husband, who has, you know, is a criminal defense attorney, he takes his phone in, his paralegal is allowed to, and if, you know, push came to shove, of course, that's not the Ghislaine Maxwell trial. That's like nothing in comparison.
Well, no, but I mean, the lawyers in both sides do bring in electronic devices.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, this is a distinction in this case in New York, for reporters whose sole job is to cover the courts, who have like, I don't know if they call it a hard pass, but they're like permanent federal court reporters in New York.
Yeah.
They actually are allowed to bring electronic devices in. But for reporters who, like us, you know, this is not the only thing we cover, we don't have those same privileges. So it's interesting, you know, I can follow along during the day. A few of the court reporters who are in there who have these hard passes, they are able to like tweet what's going on in the case. So I have a sense of what's happening before I talk to Julie because I'm able to see what they're putting out there. Of course, you know, I'm still waiting for Julie's take on it before we do anything with that. But and then obviously waiting for the transcript to fact check and flesh it out even further.
Talk to us about who has testified so far. Give us a little cast and crew rundown of witnesses.
Yes. So the first to testify was Larry Visosky, Epstein's longtime private pilot. Kind of an interesting choice. He was the first person to testify, which, you know, when I've talked to some attorneys, I think people have scratched their heads a little bit as to why the pilot was the first guy to talk. You know, what he did was establish kind of the locales that Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell traveled between. Jeffrey Epstein obviously had a mansion in Palm Beach, had a huge mansion in New York City, had a big ranch out in New Mexico, and also traveled internationally as well. But and obviously his island in the Virgin Islands, little St. James. So, but he was able to sort of set up, I guess, a little bit of the dynamic of these are the locales that they went between, which are relevant for the case because, you know, these are the locales, his homes are where the abuse was alleged to have occurred and where, you know, Maxwell was alleged to have, you know, groomed and recruited these women, you know, for this abuse to take place. So in one sense, he sort of was foundational in laying out the framework of who are these people, who's Ghislaine Maxwell, who's Jeffrey Epstein, what was their lifestyle, who was on the plane. That was something he was asked about. You know, he mentioned people like Bill Clinton and Prince Andrew having appeared on the plane, but he didn't really speak too much to the idea of, you know, the underage girls were flying on the plane. I mean, he didn't know the age. I think he testified that he recognized the first victim who spoke in the trial. He thought she was older. He didn't think of her as underage. To his knowledge, he wasn't aware of underage girls on the planes. And there have been rumors that there were sexual activity that occurred on the plane. He said, I wasn't aware of any of that. So on the one hand, he established a foundation, but does he establish this idea that, you know, there was this widespread sex trafficking operation? Maybe not. I mean, certainly he doesn't, you know, his testimony is I didn't see that. So he was the first to talk. The next witness was the first victim. All the victims, I should say, save for one, are testifying under pseudonym.
Yeah.
Even if people in the media, even if people know who they are, and certainly from their biographical details, in some cases you can kind of figure out who's testifying. We're all adhering to the pseudonyms.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the first victim is testifying under the name Jane. And so she delivered, I think her testimony was certainly the first really dramatic testimony in the trial. You know, she tells a very dramatic story about meeting Ghislaine Maxwell and soon after Jeffrey Epstein when she was a 14-year-old camper at an arts camp in Michigan.
Right.
She's eating ice cream with her friends when Ghislaine Maxwell approaches her. And, you know, very quickly she introduces them and they... She happens to be living in Palm Beach. And so they say, oh, well, we'll have you over to Jeffrey Epstein's house. And she first goes with her mother to the house, according to her testimony. But pretty quickly it transitions into she's appearing alone. And then, you know, over time it transitions into we're interested in the art in you as a young budding artist to we're interested in you sexually. And so she describes, you know, the episodes of abuse that occurred, the first encounter with Epstein, and then, you know, Ghislaine Maxwell, as she testifies, having been present for some of the abuse and having participated in some of the abuse itself, you know, in addition to the abuse that Epstein, and there was pretty graphic discussion of what was alleged to have happened. So that was, you know, the first real wrenching kind of testimony. She was broken up at various times in the testimony in describing the abuse that she alleges occurred. And in talking about the role that Maxwell played in it, interestingly, she lays out her story in the government's questioning. The defense then their real focus is on inconsistencies between what she's saying on the stand And what she has said, according to FBI reports of previous interactions she had with FBI agents, previous interviews she did, Maxwell isn't mentioned in all of those interviews. Why wasn't she mentioned? You know, the interesting thing about this is these are notes from FBI interviews. These are not verbatim transcripts. And in various points, she says, well, that's not accurate. That's not what I remember. That's not what I said. She also says at some points, you know, one of the things she said, memory's not linear, you know.
Yeah, I thought that was an interesting comment.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, you know, when you talk to people who have prosecuted these kinds of cases, you know, and then you talk to psychologists, you hear that it's not uncommon for someone who has experienced sexual abuse to not remember everything, for memories to come back at different times. You know, she described, and other people corroborated this, you know, the shame she felt about the abuse that she alleges had occurred. And clearly this was not something she was comfortable talking about. You know, one of the corroborating witnesses that was called after her was an ex-boyfriend also. So she is an actress, and the ex-boyfriend also a fellow actor. And I'll get to that interestingly in terms of what the defense's approach in a second. But, you know, he testifies about the fact that she talked about, you know, the fact that her family had this benefactor, but she was very circumspect in what she said. And it was sort of over time from what the boyfriend said that he kind of pieces together what was happening, because she didn't say to him, I was abused by Jeffrey Epstein. She says there was this guy who was a benefactor. His name was Jeffrey Epstein. Once this guy realizes, wait a second, this guy, Jeffrey Epstein, has been accused of, you know, sexually abusing all these girls. He says to her, wait, was that what was happening? And she confirms it, but not in any detail. And, you know, his testimony is she said there was this woman that would be present that made her feel more comfortable. She never said Ghislaine Maxwell's name. He says he then sees when Ghislaine Maxwell is arrested, he says he calls her up. At this point, they're actually broken up. He says to her, hey, I saw this woman, Ghislaine Maxwell, was arrested and accused of all these things. I remember you telling me there was this woman that was always present for the abuse that made you feel more comfortable. Was that Maxwell? And she says, oh, yes, that was. But I think the reason I say that is his testimony sort of suggests that this was not something she was telling as a story to people. She was not telling people, I was abused by Jeffrey Epstein. Right. Ghislaine Maxwell facilitated the abuse. Ghislaine Maxwell was present for the abuse. She was very circumspect in what she said. And it, you know, from what we gather as well from her testimony, she wasn't necessarily super forthcoming with the FBI when they first talked to her either, because she didn't want to talk about it. She was ashamed. She was uncomfortable. And so that's the argument that I think she has made and the argument the prosecutors are trying to make to explain these inconsistencies. But nevertheless, for the defense, you know, I think the sense is that that they've, you know, kind of landed some punches with that approach of pointing out these inconsistencies. The other thing they've highlighted, she and all the other victims have received payment from a compensation fund.
Yeah, it was like a $5 million civil suit.
Exactly.
Did they each get $5 million?
I think the amounts were different. So in her case, actually, she got a payout from the victim fund and had a civil suit with Maxwell. So they have, their claim is, listen, this is all for financial motivation. And they've claimed also that, you know, there's a rubric, you know, with any sort of compensation fund, whether it be in this case for victims of abuse, you know, when you go back to like the Exxon, the spill in New Orleans, whenever there's victim funds, there is some calculation of who gets what, you know, how do you determine who gets what? And the legal action, the fact that you've had legal action, theoretically it enables you to more, perhaps because it's a sign of, I guess maybe it bolsters your credibility if you've actually been willing to, you know, to put your claims in front of a court and swear that what you're saying is true. But Maxwell's team has said, well, listen, they have an incentive to be involved in this case because it's going to help their payout. That's their argument. And their incentive, their argument is, you know, they're financially motivated in doing this. Now, you know, for someone who's you know, familiar with the Epstein case in its long history, financial motives were part of the reason or the argument about financial motives were part of the reason why charges against Epstein never went to trial in the first place. You know, more than a decade ago, you know, if you go to the backstory of this, you know, Jeffrey Epstein cuts this famously very favorable deal more than a decade earlier, where he never goes to trial. He pleads guilty to a couple solicitation charges, one of which is solicitation of a minor. But it's, you know, he gets this fairly light sentence where he's able to show up to county jail and then also able to show up to an office several days a week to serve out his sentence. And part of the argument then was, well, these girls were being paid. Because the, you know, what's alleged to have occurred is you know, these girls would show up to Epstein's house for, you know, quote unquote massages, perform sexual acts ultimately on Epstein, and he gives them, you know, a couple $100 at the end and says, you know, see you next Thursday. Because of the financial motivations and because of the fact that many of these girls were coming from troubled backgrounds and continue to be troubled afterwards, part of the reasoning for not bringing this to trial was this idea that Epstein's lawyers were going to rip these girls apart on the stand. And, you know, some of the prosecutors even said, well, I was doing this in part to protect the girls. I don't know if the girls agreed with that. And I don't know if that's what the girls wanted. Many of them at that point were women, but that was part of the idea. And so, in a sense, the fact that financial motivations would be a focal point for Maxwell's defense team fits in with the historical narrative that's always underpinned this case, you know, going back to the original charges that Epstein faced in Florida, you know, more than a decade earlier.
Well, one of your questions would be, or one of the things to discuss would be, is, you know, how much did these girls' parents or caretakers know? I mean, right. If you have a 14-year-old daughter and all of a sudden she's going to a mansion in Palm Beach and you live like, you know, way west of the Everglades, what's right. wrong with this picture, Mom? What did you think was happening? So
right. And yeah. that actually has come up. I mean, so in the first victim, Jane, so her boyfriend actually, and I don't think Jane actually testified this, her boyfriend testified about this, that at some point she confronted her mother about this and said, you know, listen, so her story, just to spell out her story, her father was a prominent figure, a composer, he died. And when he died, it kind of left the family a little bit in financial ruin. Apparently his healthcare bills weren't fully covered. The family was in financial distress. As she tells it, they were living in like the pool house of a friend's house. You know, okay. It's clear that they came from a sophisticated background, had sophisticated friends, but were struggling financially. And she talks about that, you know, her mother wanted to still keep up appearances, but financially they were suffering. And so Epstein comes in and dangles that he's going to offer this financial support. He's going to pay for her to go to camp. He's going to pay for her voice lessons. He's going to pay for all sorts of things. And the mother just takes him up on it and, you know, maybe doesn't ask questions. There's one meeting where the mother is present, but from that point forward, she's going to his house alone. And you know, according to the ex-boyfriend, she confronts the mother and says, how did you not know? This money wasn't free. I had to do things for it. How did you not know it? And as he describes it, they had a very difficult, tortured relationship. And I think this was a big part of it, that, you know, she felt, you know, the mother wasn't adequately protecting her and confronted her about it later, but also felt special. And, you know, that was, you know, that's a hallmark of these kinds of cases is, you know, part of the success is you take girls who are in difficult circumstances, who maybe aren't getting the kind of attention and affection that they might want to be getting from their parents, and you shower them with it. And at first they feel special. And that's the crux of this whole case for the government is Ghislaine Maxwell's role was to make them feel special and to normalize them to the idea that it was not abnormal for them to participate in sexual activities. It's sort of like, you know, you're boiling the lobster in the pot, you just slowly raise the temperature. And before you know it, you know, there's sexual abuse is occurring.
Can you tell us anything about the makeup of the jury?
You know, I haven't seen the jury, so I can't tell you in terms of the makeup. What I can tell you is they were obviously, and this is a challenging thing, they were trying to screen people based on their understanding of this trial and based on their
understanding
of Maxwell
Epstein. How much foreknowledge they had.
Right, which is hard to, you know, it's hard to think that, you know, this story has been such a big story.
Yeah.
The other sort of interesting dynamic, and this is like a minor detail, but the trial is anticipated to last for as long as 6 weeks. Which, because it started right after Thanksgiving, means that they needed to talk to people about like potential conflicts around Christmas and New Year's. And so one of the jurors actually was excused on the first or second day of the trial because I think it was his wife had planned a vacation and surprised him with it. And they couldn't get a refund on their vacation. So he had to be excused because he was going to have to miss too much time for the trial. But that's been an issue. One of the jurors, apparently on the first day, one of the jurors, there was some issue because one of the jurors who was in the who had made the first round of screenings forgot to show up. forgot to show up for court.
Okay.
So
what do you think that person has going on in their life that they're going to forget? Good grief. They're going to forget to show up for a Ghislaine Maxwell trial. Got it.
Yeah. So it's interesting. But it, I mean, to the point of the jury, it's an interesting thing. One of the things that I think is interesting to keep in mind is you know, we know so much about Ghislaine Maxwell because of all the coverage over the years. There's been so much attention to her. When you think about Ghislaine Maxwell, there's always been this sort of two parts to her story, right? There's the one part that she's alleged to have been involved in this abuse with Epstein. And then the one part where, you know, she has this big connection to royalty, to presidents. You know, she's seen by many as being the one who really introduced Epstein to so many of these prominent figures that then they've been associated with over the years, the presidents, the members of royal families, the, you know, the business leaders all over the world. And that part of her is not so much really in focus at the trial. And so really the trial is focused exclusively on her role as the alleged groomer and recruiter of these girls. And that is significant, but when you take out, you know, the fact that she has these connections to members of the royal family and presidents and such, her role is less significant, maybe not less significant, but her role, the allure, the mystique of Ghislaine Maxwell is necessarily reduced, because at that point, she's not that different than, you know, any recruiter for a pimp. And in sex trafficking cases, you hear often that there is a female recruiter who may herself have started out being a victim who brings in other women into the enterprise. And so when you take out this element of the social aspect of it, she might seem not that different than those women who are prosecuted and stand trial, you know, all the time in the US, whose trials are not considered to be extraordinary cases. The extraordinary element with Ghislaine Maxwell is who is in her Rolodex, who is in her black book, which is one of the pieces of evidence that's being considered at the trial.
Let's divert just briefly into Ghislaine Maxwell's tried at least four times to be released on bond, and Judge Allison Nathan has shut her down every single time. I just find it highly ironic that Ghislaine Maxwell's attorneys are complaining about a light being shined in her eyes to make sure she's still awake or still alive, and that she is under 15-minute supervision. They may be overcompensating for the death of Jeffrey Epstein, but isn't that ironic that they would complain about that? Of course, they would complain if she weren't under supervision. It's like, you know, they can't win here.
I mean, on the one hand, it's their job, right? I mean, their job is to get the best conditions for their client as possible. I think that, you know, what I've long thought is that to some extent, the very beginning of you know, when Maxwell was first arrested, she was seen at the time as being fairly evasive about her finances. Ultimately, she provided more information, but her initial answers when she was asked about her finances, when she asked about various details, she was fairly evasive. And I think it's been very hard, I think, to overcome that first impression.
Right. Well, her finances changed, you know, from motion to motion. Every time the attorneys filed a motion or someone else made an objection, the prosecution, she came up with a different financial statement. And then she was married, then she wasn't married. Her family didn't know she was married. She's really the author of all of her own problems, all of her own credibility issues.
No, I think it's been very difficult to make up for that. And, you know, the whole time, you know, the argument effectively when you release someone on bail, the whole idea is one, I've given you a full accounting of my finances, and I'm telling you that this amount of money that I've put up makes a significant impact on me. And so that's going to keep me from going. And two, you know, take me at my word. I'm not going to leave. Well, when you start off not being straightforward about your finances, and you know, there's still a thought that, well, maybe there's hidden accounts somewhere else that we're not aware of. It's hard to, you know, I think it's made it very difficult to believe that any package she's offering is necessarily every last penny being accounted for. And so I think it's been very hard for her to overcome that. And it's hard to make the case when there's hundreds, thousands of other people are being held in detention. It's hard to make the case, well, they don't deserve to be released, but you do. So I think that's been interesting. And it has been fascinating. You know, we in the public, and as you said, many of her family members had no idea that she was married before all of this. That level of mystery has been kind of amazing. And I think it's been very hard for her to overcome that. You know, there has also, she holds citizenships from the UK and France. Yes. France typically does not extradite its citizens. And so she has said, I'm not going to go to France, trust me. But when, you know, when we have all these other instances where your credibility doesn't necessarily
add up.
Yeah, it's, you know, and she's at one point, she offered to renounce her citizenship, but still it's hard to enforce.
Doesn't matter.
These things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So she's never, I don't think she's ever really been able to overcome that. And after the first couple of times, I mean, the last rejection, you know, it was very quick. There wasn't a lot of debate. It was a quick, yeah, this isn't happening. You're not leaving.
Well, she has a history of, let's just say she's got a really interesting background. I find it commendable that her older brothers and sisters are so devoted to her. I think they're pretty darn naive. Okay, there you go.
It's interesting. I mean, her family history has its question marks as well. Her father died under mysterious circumstances. And after his death, there were all these revelations about, you know, the degree to which he had looted the company's pension fund, massive amounts of money. Yep. Her brothers were involved in, you know, huge bankruptcy cases, which in and of itself, a bankruptcy is not a sign that there's anything necessarily wrong with you. But the point is, there are a lot of red flags in her family's background as well, before she ever enters into the picture. And certainly no allegations of any sort of criminality, certainly in this regard. Although with the father, with the looting of the pension fund, you know, financial crimes, perhaps. But so, yeah, I mean, you sort of take that with a grain of salt, and you take their defense of her with a grain of salt. And listen, I mean, she points to, her lawyers have pointed to, you know, why is Harvey Weinstein, why was he able to remain out on bail? Why was Bill Cosby able to remain out on bail? And maybe maybe there's a point to be made in that regard. I would say that, you know, again, the fact that there was all this confusion at the beginning, that there was all this evasiveness at the beginning, it's just, that's, I think that set the die, and it's been hard to overcome that.
All right. And Weinstein and Cosby also did not have triplicate citizenship.
Right.
I mean, it wasn't like they could flee to France. Ben, I know we're going to be talking about this again. We could probably talk about it the rest of the day. Yes. Thanks for your time. And just jot down things that you'd like to talk about, because I know we'll revisit this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'd be happy to.
Thanks for listening to Primetime Crime, the podcast. Follow us on Facebook at Primetime Crime and on Instagram and Twitter at PrimetimeCrime_. Post your comments and tell us what true crime stories you'd like to hear about. Subscribe to Primetime Crime on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and Google Podcasts. Thanks a lot.